Do it again.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world.
You're listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.
Hey girl, a martini, shaken, not stirred.
Don't try and church it up, son.
You can't handle the truth.
I am big. The picture that got small.
Your first one's on us.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling. I'm your host, Mark Rigadon, and with me, as always,
Richie Byrne,
and your producer, Soul Joel.
Today, we have a very special guest.
I know we say that a lot, but we really
this
do
This is
today.
A special guest?
This is a special
how
guest.
How many books? Two?
Five.
Five.
Wow.
You way overshot my thought.
A mainstay.
I know of two.
I had to apologize because I thought we were talking about his book. And he goes, no, we're going to talk about my most recent book, which is hot right now, about your healing and meditation.
Yeah, it just became a bestseller on Amazon. But am I allowed to talk before you introduce me?
That's what he sounds like. Jeffrey Gurian.
Jeffrey Gurian. Yes.
Hey, thank you, guys.
A mainstay in the New York
comedy
scene.
It's
so cool to be here with you guys.
You're a staple of the entire comedy
scene. A staple. That's an unusual, right?
No,
out
it's
of a
true.
Stapler.
You're no, part
it's
no,
that's
of
nice.
It.
Thank you.
You're
thank
part
you.
Of all of it, man. And we're here live at the Comic Strip, which ironically you have a book.
About the comic strip.
Isn't that somewhat a small world that I should happen to have a book about the comic strip? It was a labor.
Segway.
It was a labor of love that took 4 years to do.
Wow.
4 years.
It was a tremendous amount of work. Yeah, because we interviewed.
Now, what is the book? Tell us a little
about
it.
Well, the newest version is called Laughing Legends, and it's called How the Comic Strip Changed the Face of Comedy.
Oh, man.
And
that's a deep subject.
Yeah, well, you know, it was the third comedy club ever in existence. Bud Friedman opened the Improv in 1963, and he opened it as a coffee shop. It wasn't a it wasn't a comedy club for a while. He had singers would come in and
jazz
Broadway
singers,
actors,
opera singers.
People would hang
yeah.
out, you know. And Danny Aiello was the bouncer, which is
I
how
heard stories
which is how
about
he
that.
Got so connected to the comedy world, you know, and wound up with his own club out in New Jersey for a while. But
woof.
It wasn't
woof.
Until the end. It wasn't until the end of 1972 that Rick Newman opened Catch a Rising Star. And then on June 1st of 76, Richie Tinkin and his partners opened this club where we're sitting right now, which is the only club of the three originals that is still open to this
wow.
day. So
now when this opened, it was in New York City, obviously. We're
mm-hmm.
in New York City. But then what inspired the clubs of, like, Los Angeles and Vegas, like they were more nightclubs, right?
Yeah, well,
but
it,
so
like
were, so was the Improv here. I mean, in the beginning, right?
Yeah, it
was
a coffee shop. Basically,
what was Catch? Was Catch? Was
Catch?
Catch
was a comedy
it,
club
it was
from the beginning,
primarily.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
And
I didn't know if that was
the reason that Richie opened the strip was because he had a bartender who wanted to do impressions, whose name is escaping me for the moment, but he's in this book. And
you have to get the book to find out the name.
Right, and he went to audition at Catch one night, and when Richie came down to support him with a whole bunch of people, they were amazed to see lines around the block. I remember when Catch opened, it was crazy
yeah.
because there weren't comedy clubs. There was
yeah.
this one club, the Improv, lines around the block, and Richie started coming down there every night, and he saw every night there was lines around the block, and he figured there's probably room for another club. And he had never, you know, he was a bar owner from the Bronx. He owned five bars.
You.
He will tell you for sure, you know. And so
multiple times.
It was a real leap of faith, you know. And he hooked up with John McGowan and Bob Wax, and they opened this. They found this club while they were riding in a taxi on the way to meet with Bob Wax. Richie looked out the window, and he's like, what location do you want? And they saw this empty bar here. And they told the cab to pull over, and they looked in the window, and this is the club that
wow.
became the comic strip.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man,
isn't that
that's
cool
serious?
Story? Yeah.
Just told the cab to pull over.
That's synchronicity. They were in the cab.
You know, that
this
cab
block.
Driver wants a percentage.
Wow.
Yeah. Probably. Probably. So the club always fascinated me. I was here in the very early days, you know. It opened on June 1st. The June 17th, Jerry Seinfeld came in to audition, and his
it was a 76.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
June 17th
wow.
of 1976. And his sign-up sheet is in the book here, a copy of it, of course. In those days when
it's
you'd
the
come
original.
In...
the original. Buy the book.
Right. In those days when you'd come in to audition, they would rate you. You would audition for one of the owners. Like George Wallace auditioned before the club was even open.
Huh.
While it was still under construction.
Wow.
He was selling advertising. Because George
oh
was always
God.
Very successful. And he sold them advertising. When the club opened, every bus on 1st and 2nd Avenue had a sign on the back, "Eat, Drink, and Laugh at the Comic Strip." And when we did the documentary film on the strip, that's the title of it, Eat, Drink, and Laugh, because that was the original logo of the club.
And did George come up with that?
Look at that.
That's great.
Wow. Know that.
And Seinfeld's sign-up sheet says, "This guy's going nowhere. He talks about nothing."
Exactly. It actually said good. They rated him good and said, "Let him come back on Monday." He came in, I guess, on a Friday to audition. And he became the...
Usually it's the other way around. You come in on a Monday.
Usually. Yeah. But he became the earliest MC. Like, in the shortest amount of time, he became an MC at the club. And then quit his...
Wow.
He had one job before that and then never did anything but comedy again. Because he said he was making like $45 a week, which was huge in those days. Funny enough,
that's what I'm still making.
He roomed with George Wallace. They were roommates and they're best friends to this day.
They still are, yeah.
I actually came with George when Jerry filmed his recent Netflix special here.
At the comic strip.
I came with George to watch.
They remade it to look like the old days.
Like it did in 1976.
I was going to say, the comic strip is still staying relevant even after your book was published. Sandler just filmed it here as well.
Yeah, I was there for that too. It was amazing. It was a secret.
It's not a real show if Jeffrey's not there. Seriously.
Well, that's kind of you.
No, it's the truth, man. It's the truth.
Yeah, the man. So. We were actually supposed to be here recording the night Sandler did his special.
Yeah.
We got bumped.
Understandably.
Yeah.
And it was a very interesting special. He only did that one taping for 2 hours. Most people come in and they'll do two tapings, like an hour apiece. He spent 2 hours on stage. He had his own keyboardist. And he sang songs and told jokes. And it was amazing watching
him do this.
But I was always fascinated by this club. So... When I had the idea for the book, I presented it. I was here with Gilbert Gottfried, and we were coaching Ann Curry on how to do stand-up comedy. I don't remember what the thing was, but she had to do comedy for something on the news. And so we were coaching her, and then I'm standing there with Richie, and I'm looking at the walls and the history of this club, and I'm like, "Did anybody ever do a book on this club?" And he's like, "No." And I said, "Well, I would like to do that." And so he said, "Well, we'll talk about it." So he came to my house. And he saw that I had more pictures on my wall, he said, than he has at the club.
Oh, really?
If no one's been to the comic strip.
There's a lot of pictures on the walls here.
It's covered.
200 at least.
I have more than that. I have pictures that go back 30 years. You know, Milton Berle was my sponsor in the Friars Club.
Wow.
So I have pictures.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
I think you told me that once. I forgot about
it. It's the truth. I have pictures with Milton back in 1985.
Do you have any pictures of his proof? That he's...
He showed it to me once.
I'm sure he did.
And not because I asked to see it either.
He showed him just enough to impress him.
Yeah, we happened to be in the men's room of the L.A. Friars. At the time, there was a Friars Club in Los Angeles, and he was the president. And so we happened to be in the men's room, and he goes, "Jeff, you want to see something?" And before I had a chance to say no,
it went around your shoulder.
It was out.
Are you serious?
I thought a fucking python got loose. Dude. It was crazy.
But that's so cool.
It was
cool.
Ridiculous. He just whipped it out.
Excited.
I was like,
"No, yeah," because Milton Berle's dick is famous. Like,
it's famous.
Did you get its autograph?
That's how I got to meet him, by the way. Listen to this. I got to meet him. I was writing
Before you
jokes.
Know it, you're a member of the Friars.
I was writing jokes for the Friars Roast for years. For like 12 years, I was the head writer
under
a guy named Bob Sachs, who was the producer of the Roast. And I wrote this joke. I said, if Burl's cock had a blonde wig, it could pass for Paul Williams. When Burl heard the joke, he started using that. He said, "I want to meet the guy who wrote that joke." He called it the Burl's cock joke. And Dick Capri did the joke. I don't know if you know Dick.
I just saw Dick in Florida a couple of weeks ago.
He's the first comedian that I ever wrote for.
Dick Capri.
Wonderful guy. Still out there doing it.
He was in Catskills on Broadway. And he's just a fantastic comedian. And so he brought me over to meet Milton. And we became friends. And I wrote a lot of jokes about his schlong. You know, it was like,
Jeffrey.
The first
for all people
I
at home,
did,
I am blushing right now.
The first book that I ever did was called Filthy, Funny, and Totally Offensive. In 2007, I was asked to do a book about celebrities' favorite dirty jokes.
Because of my history.
So 250 celebrities, Jason Alexander and Joan Rivers.
Which one of the dirtiest ones?
Oh, geez, I can't even say them. And I don't remember all of them because there was
hundreds.
There was huge. It was just amazing. Was Milton. But one of the jokes, the first page and the last page were my jokes. And Paul Provenza wrote the introduction for me.
Yeah, Paul.
Right, of course. And so we were going over the material, and I was telling him the jokes, and I said to him, you know, Burl would have loved to be here today, but he had a little accident in his hotel room. He was fucking this chick, and on his way over to the bed, he accidentally tripped and pole vaulted out the window. And so, but before I could finish the joke, Provenza interrupted me, and he goes, you wrote the pole vaulting joke? And I'm like, you know that joke? He goes, that's a fucking classic joke.
You
Everybody
wrote
knows
the
that
pole
joke.
Vaulting
the pole
joke.
Vaulting joke.
We got our joke for the episode.
Yeah, there it is.
He knew the joke. The pole vaulting joke.
The
yeah.
Paul Williams joke. And before
so
the show, we said, do you have a joke?
I know.
For
and he
us?
Said, oh, I wish you guys would have let me know ahead of time.
I would have prepared. Now let me unleash two legends that I wrote.
In later years, I'm friendly with Paul Williams, and I could never tell him that story.
Well,
I was afraid.
Guess
that
what?
He
listens to the podcast.
Yeah, he probably does. He's the president of ASCAP. He's such a wonderful guy.
That's right. He is.
Just like,
yeah, he's the president of ASCAP.
Yeah. So that was the story.
He does side work as Milton Burrow's cock.
Now, when you
we interviewed everybody for this book, and they all came into the club except Billy Crystal. Did we do something wrong?
No, they're still
or the
on
lights
the show.
Went out? Oh, yeah.
They heard the last joke. They said, you guys are
it,
done.
Right? No, I interviewed Billy Crystal.
Everybody came here except for Billy Crystal.
Yeah, who I interviewed in Beverly Hills in his office. We couldn't ask Billy to fly in. So I was out there, and I went to see him. And
it's not a bad trip.
No, it
go
was
go to Beverly Hills
to
see Billy Crystal.
Him. It was amazing. And there's pictures in the book of he and I. Well, I don't know if you know, but I used to be a dentist. And
I did not know.
I did.
Yeah, and Billy knew because he was managed by Jack Rollins. And when I met Billy back in the 70s, Jack Rollins had wanted to do a sitcom based on my story about a dentist who was in show business, and he wanted Billy to play me. And that's how I first met Billy and Robin Williams.
Wow.
Because I was a kid, and I was going up to Jack Rollins' office all the time. Jack left us recently at 100 years old.
Wow.
He passed away about 2 years ago, I think.
I heard some really great stories about him that, he paid money out of his own pocket to get tires for Billy Crystal.
Oh, he was the nicest guy in the world. Such an unusual, an old-time show business character that there'll never be another kind. Just a wonderful human being, and he was so nice to me. And I also got to meet Charlie Jaffe, his partner. You know, every Woody Allen movie at the end says...
Charles Jaffe.
Yeah, it says... Rollins and Joffrey.
Rollins and
production.
Joffrey. Yeah.
So I never thought I'd even know those guys. Woody Allen read my earliest material. It was crazy.
Really?
Yeah. But
that's
see,
wild.
I have so many stories. I confused myself. There was a particular story that I wanted to tell you about.
Well, you said everybody came here except for Billy Crystal.
Oh yeah. That's right. So
you know it's bad when I'm remembering.
No, that's
when,
great.
When Richie's the voice
like
of reason, we're in trouble.
But who was the other? Who didn't come here?
There's a picture in the book of me and Billy, and he's pointing to his teeth because he remembered that. But he remembered in the middle of our interview. I'm doing the interview, and we're talking about the early days, and all of a sudden he goes to me, oh, my God, you're the funny dentist, right? And I'm like, I hate that reference. But he goes, Alan King that used to call you that because I knew Alan, the funny dentist from then. I said, I hate that reference. Because I never wanted to.
So if we're on a show, can I call you that?
No, never. No.
You don't want your worlds colliding.
Yeah, I never did. When I wrote for Joan Rivers, she didn't find out till months later. So her assistant saw something about me on television, and Joan called me from Las Vegas early in the morning, and I was still in practice, and my nurse had strict instructions, never interrupt me unless it's for show business. So she would come in.
Of course.
Hysterical.
Hey.
So she would come in and
your
she'd
entire
say,
family died in a plane wreck.
What did I say?
I said, leave me alone.
Were they on stage?
Right.
Joan Rivers has a compliment for you. I'll take the call.
Right. So she would call up and she'd say, Dr. Rivers is on the phone. Dr. Burl is calling. The only one that no one believed was Dr. Dangerfield.
I was going to say.
She couldn't get away with that, right? So Joan calls.
Dr. Vinny Bubat.
Exactly. And I wrote some of those for him, too.
For
so,
real?
Yeah, he was the first big star I ever wrote for, Rodney.
Oh, my God.
After writing for these other guys, that's how I met Rodney, and I started writing stuff, and he did it on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and on his first album, No Respect.
Mm-hmm.
He did a very politically incorrect joke of mine on his album, No Respect. He goes, you know, I only get ugly girls. He goes, I met one girl. She was so ugly, I bent down to pet her cat. It was the hair on her legs. She was a very ugly girl. And he did. Oh, he did so many of my jokes. And it was such a thrill to write for Rodney.
And he'd pay you $50. Is that true?
Yeah, I used to get $50. I used to get checks in the mail from him. He was so honest.
He was honest. Yeah, he'd pay anybody who wrote him a joke. And he'd remember the joke. And
he appreciated it so much.
But it was
I still have copies. I still have copies of those. Yeah, in the days when people paid $5 a joke, he paid $50.
See?
What a class.
There you go. Wow. Yeah.
And he once paid me $250 for a joke that he used as an opener with Carson. And again, a very simple joke, you know, and I can't do a Rodney impression, but, he had a stock opening.
Everyone can do a little bit of a Rodney.
I'm all right now, but last week was rough. You know, he says, I bought one of those whirlpools for my bathtub. The first night I used it, I lost three of my best ships. And he liked that joke so much because for TV, you had to be clean in those days, right?
Yeah.
Because that's such a perfect, clean joke. And he used that as his opening with Carson.
Oh, my God.
And he paid me $250 for it.
So, wait, joke tally. What are we up to now?
A lot.
Yeah,
we got a lot of
said,
jokes.
Oh, you should have. I don't have any jokes.
No, because I thought you said a street joke. These were jokes that people, you know, did on stage. Like
yeah,
on
but they're still jokes.
They're still jokes. Yeah, they still qualify as jokes.
And
So they all came in here, Jim Gaffigan, Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and we all sat down. As a matter of fact, when Jim came in, I don't think Richie was free that day, but on the others, it was me, Richie, and Jerry, and me, Richie, and Chris Rock. And it was just very relaxed, and they stayed, and they talked for at least an hour.
Wow.
And you know who's in the...
To get there that time from those people.
Yeah.
That's why it took 4 years.
If you want an hour of, like, Chris Rock, like, you have to give him, like, 50
grand. I mean, look at this.
Yeah, I know.
Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Billy Crystal, Ray Romano, Paul Reiser, Gilbert, Susie Essman, Colin Quinn, Paul Provenza. Gaffigan, Martling... Wayne Fetterman. Wow.
Wayne Fetterman.
Sherrod, Lewis Black, Chuda.
How about Wayne Cotter? You guys remember Wayne Cotter?
I remember Wayne
Cotter.
Wayne Cotter was very
good. The Comic Strip Live, which was a very different...
You don't remember Wayne Cotter?
Not by face.
He was
big.
John Mulroney hosted
the
Comic Strip Live TV show, which was not related to the club, right?
No. It wasn't related to the club. I just remembered that when I started the book, it was at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. Oh, yeah. And my first three interviews were George Wallace, Larry Miller.
I love
who
was
love
up there,
Larry Miller. He's in my top three.
And Paul Provenza. Yeah, and that's what kicked off the book. And that I didn't want to present it to a publisher until I had all the interviews, because when you're dealing with such big stars, there's no guarantee that you're going to get everybody. And I didn't want to promise a publisher something until I had it in my hands. So I basically almost finished the book before we went to a publisher. But it was
smart, though. That's smart.
It was because I...
But I'm smart.
I had a feeling that we could get all these names, but it was amazing to sit with them.
Yeah, it must have been.
For at least an hour at a time and talking about, you know...
Just...
Their
the
history
beginnings.
And how they got started, and you know,
it's what
great
we
stories.
Do here.
Did you know that Ray Romano got started under the name Jackie Roberts? Do you know that story?
No.
Yeah. Well, in the early days, there was just the Improv, and if you wanted to perform at the Improv, there was a lottery, and you'd go and you put your name in a hat, and they would pick you. If they picked your name out of the hat, you'd get to go up on stage. So, Ray was going in, and he wanted to double his chances. So he brought a friend with him.
A cheater.
But he couldn't find a guy, so he brought a girl. So he says to the girl, listen, I can't go up under a girl's name.
Wait.
Yeah?
So he could not find a male comedian.
Male friend.
He needed a female to do it.
Exactly.
I'm calling bullshit on diversity. All the diversity.
Well, this was a long time ago. There was no diversity, right? It was so funny. So he asked this girl, and he tells her, "You have to pick an androgynous name because I can't go up under a girl's name." So she picks the name Jackie Roberts. Silva Friedman's there. They're picking names out of the hat, and they pick his name. Of course, Jackie Roberts goes up on stage, kills, passes the audition. And now he has to go on stage as Jackie Roberts because he can't tell the owner that he lied about his name.
Okay, but there's one problem. What if they picked Jackie Roberts and Ray Romano?
Oh, he didn't put in his own name. Oh, wait a minute.
No,
he
had to
because
he wanted
name.
To double his chances.
And he wanted to, that's right. So I guess they didn't pick Ray Romano.
Well, he went up as Ray, didn't do well.
And they only picked Jackie Roberts.
Oh my God! So, I so want to run into Ray Romano and ask him about this.
For the first two, it's in the book. The story's there, straight from Ray Romano. So he went up as Jackie Roberts, and then he bombed one night. He said in the beginning he had beginner's luck, and he was doing great. And then all of a sudden one night he bombed terribly, and he lost his courage. And he didn't go back on stage for 2 years. He went back to selling futons.
Yes, selling futons.
Was, that was his best friend's job, which is why on Everybody Loves Raymond, that was one of the
That's how he met his wife
episodes.
On Everybody Loves Raymond. I think he did in real life, too.
He actually sold a futon to Larry David.
Yeah.
And Larry David didn't like it.
Yeah. Shocker.
No. He wasn't happy with it. And he made him return it. Yeah. He said
Isn't that interesting, though, that like he did well in the beginning, and then when he bombed, he quit.
He quit. But when he came back as Ray Romano. When he came back to this club.
Right. So wait a minute. Jackie Roberts sucked. Ray Romano was great.
He was great. And he came Romano back to this club. And this is where he met Rory Rosegarten, who's his manager
his
to
manager
this
day.
To this day.
Shout out to Rory.
Loyal show business stories. I just spoke to Rory recently. And he's got the same people. The Regan brothers are still with him.
Yeah.
Robert Klein is still with him.
He's had the same that same crew for 30
Brian Regan? Is.
Yeah, and Dennis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Like
and Robert Klein is still with him.
He
was his first client, Robert Klein.
Really?
Robert Klein
changed comedy.
Yes, he did.
Like the
There's
guy.
A whole book about
he
it.
He and David Brenner were the first people to do observational comedy.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed? Before that, it was jokes. People wrote jokes. When I was coming up,
Catskilly.
You had to learn how to write a premise and then build jokes around it. Comics would call it a hunk. I don't think they use that term anymore.
No.
Comics would say, like, write me a hunk of material.
Yeah.
A hunk.
Yeah, and I used to write pounds of jokes, they would say. For Rodney, you had to give him pounds of jokes for him to take even one.
Yeah.
And I would say to Rodney, Rodney, look at all the jokes I wrote you. And he goes, yeah, Jeff, but they got to be funny, you know?
I love it.
Well, that's like Judd Apatow on that Gary Shandling.
Oh, my God.
Did you see it?
I didn't see it yet, but I heard it's
very
good.
Phenomenal.
But
it's
Apatow,
right up your alley.
You would love it. You would
book.
Love it. Apatow tells the story about when Shandling was hosting the Emmys, Apatow wrote 30 jokes, and he gave them to Shandling. And he said he used every joke, but he only used the premise. He rewrote the punchline, and they were all funnier than what I wrote. That's hysterical.
Those are great stories.
Yeah,
those are great stories. I used to sit with Rodney, and he would wear a bathrobe and pajamas.
Of course
he did. Not a nice bathrobe, but just a bathrobe and pajamas. And he would say to me stuff like, hey, Jeff, what's the difference between Jews and Italians? And I'm like, I don't know, Rodney. What's the difference? He goes, they both take a leak in the sink, but the Jews take the dishes out first.
Oh, another great joke. Oh, God.
And I was like amazed. I'm like a kid. I'm sitting there with Rodney, and he's telling me these jokes. And it was like the most exciting time for me.
Man,
it was just incredible.
That
absolutely
to me,
incredible.
Like when I'm happiest was when I was working at Stand Up New York, and I was just a puppy, and all the older comics would come in, and they would, you know, hey, what do you think of this? And what do you think? And they would just want to like talk shop with you. Then once they found out that I was doing comedy, they didn't want to talk shop
anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to be my pal.
Oh, that's funny.
You know?
Yeah.
Did it mean something to you that Jerry came back and did that special before there was Jerry?
Yeah, well, it was a big surprise, actually. It was very hard to get Jerry to come in. His schedule is so crazy. Even when they wanted to come in, it literally took months to schedule them. And when he came in, he couldn't have been nicer. He was like, it was amazing. He came in ready to talk and reminisce and so friendly. But he didn't do the documentary film that we were doing. And so we hadn't seen him for a long time. So it was a wonderful thing that he decided to come back and be loyal to the club where he started. He spent 4 years here. From 1976 to 1980, this was his home club. Richie gave him hamburgers. He wore his jacket very proudly. You know, when we interviewed Alan Combs, who unfortunately passed away
not too long ago,
Alan Combs came to the interview wearing his original comic strip jacket.
Really?
That looked like it just came out of the closet. Yeah, it was so perfect.
God.
He was so, and he literally shed tears. He was crying during the interview because he said that this was the first club that ever gave comedians a schedule. The other clubs, you'd have to come and sit sometimes for hours hoping to get on stage. They wouldn't give you a schedule. And if anyone better known than you came in, you would get bumped and you'd have to just sit there. But this club actually gave people a schedule. And, you know, so many people thought that Lucian owned the club because when Richie was with Eddie Murphy, he was out in L.A. for years.
The years I came here, I never met Richie.
And so Lucian ran the club for 25 years, right, and everyone thought that he was actually the owner of the club. Richie didn't mind. He was actually the carpenter. He actually physically built the club.
Who did?
Lucian? He thought he was a Broadway dancer and a carpenter.
So does that mean Seamus is going to be the next guy?
If you look on the walls outside, on these wooden walls, you'll see notches in the walls.
Yes.
Lucian made those all over the club. He took an awl or something, and he made these marks in the wall. When the club was finished being built, Richie said to him, so what are you going to do now? He said, I'm going to try to get a job as a dancer again. And Richie said to him, well, why don't you stay and be a bartender? And he said, well, I don't know how to be a bartender. And Richie said, well, if someone asks for a beer.
You built the goddamn club.
If someone asks for a beer, you give them a beer. Now you're a bartender. So he stayed to learn to be a bartender, and he did that for a long time. And then Richie was booking the club.
I wish I knew this back in the day. This is interesting.
Isn't it? I love these stories. Richie was booking the club from L.A. originally, and then he would call Lucian on the phone, and that's how he taught him how to book the club. And then, because he realized he couldn't do it effectively from Los Angeles, that he had an office on the Paramount lot with Eddie, and then he taught Lucian how to book the club.
Which we shouldn't skim over that.
No, did Eddie come in? Did Eddie come in?
No, he was going to do a phoner with me, but I didn't do any phoners with anybody. I just had this feeling.
Eddie didn't.
It's not personal.
Eddie Murphy.
This is the whole reason he had a career.
Eddie Murphy. This is the place.
Yeah, he
man.
Said. The story that I heard, we met with his representatives. He said that he didn't like to talk about his past. He just wasn't able to make it. And he did say that he would talk to me on the phone, as I said. But I just didn't feel like a phone conversation would be the same thing. There's something about sitting with somebody in person.
I agree with
you. The energy is different.
Yeah,
a phone
conversation
is very impersonal. It's not. You know,
I can't look someone in the eye.
So it was unfortunate.
There's a famous story about Eddie showing up here with an attitude.
In a dashiki.
got on stage, and they kicked him out. Or
he did get on
demanding
stage.
Demanding to go on or something?
No, he came in, and he wanted Richie to see how he was doing, and he was dressed in an African dashiki, and he went up on stage, and Richie wasn't particularly impressed with what he did.
Right.
And it was an awkward moment, because he came off, and he expected Richie to tell him that he did great. But Richie was loyal to him in all those years. He stood up for him, even after Eddie fired him, you know. At Eddie's dad's funeral, I think Richie protected him from the press because the press was all there and they wanted to get close to him and talk to him, and Richie didn't feel that it was proper, and he protected him and he made sure that they didn't get to see him, and he did a lot of things like that.
That's
like,
cool.
Because he felt like he was Eddie's dad. I mean, when Eddie was looking for a manager, a lot of people had approached him to manage him. And he said that he didn't trust the black managers that came to him. He didn't really trust anybody. And
especially King Broder.
Well, and Eddie's mother said to him, who do you trust most in the world? And he said, Richie. So when he asked Richie at first, Richie turned him down because he's like, I don't know how to manage anybody.
Right.
He didn't want the responsibility of managing anybody,
someone's
life. And Eddie already had stuff going on. But after Eddie talked about it with his mom, he came back to Richie again, and he said, I really want you to manage me. And Richie thought about it, and he agreed to do it. And he said right away he was dealing with the heavyweights in show business.
Because it happened overnight.
He said, with no experience, he was dealing with these top executives in film, and he's the one who got Eddie into being a cast member on SNL. He was just a featured player at first. But Joe Piscopo was on the show, and he was a big advocate of Eddie's. And one night, the show was running 5 minutes short. Gene Dumanian was the producer.
Right.
And they needed somebody to stretch. And they asked Joe to do it. And Joe said, why don't you let Eddie do it?
Which is so, how cool is that a Joe?
That's awesome.
Joe Piscopo.
Right. He
Shout
gave
out
that,
to Joe
he
Piscopo.
He gave that to Eddie. And Eddie was concerned. He called Richie. He goes, Rich, they want me to do 5 minutes, but I curse. And Richie said, well, then don't curse.
There's a good manager right there. Brilliant.
And from what Richie told me, he actually did curse, and they bleeped it. But he saved the show. And so when it came time for contracts, Richie went in and sat down with Gene Dumanian, and she said she wanted to renew his contract, but as a featured player. And Richie said, he saved your show. Don't you think he should be a regular cast member?
Yeah, they wouldn't. He wasn't a regular cast member.
Are you serious?
Right. And they bumped him up to be a regular cast member, and he said he went from $750 a week to $3,000 a week.
Wow.
And that's when Richie started taking his percentage.
Jeffrey, I have to say something. I think it's, on behalf of you guys, you're a perfect example of how not to judge a book by its cover. I don't really know you that well. I know to see you, but I don't think you knew me very well. But I know your reputation and these stories and
your
connections.
I was saying,
and
we got to get
your
Jeffrey
resume.
On.
I didn't know all these things, yeah. And I'm very impressed, and I'm very glad that we made this happen today. I mean, yeah.
Well,
it's amazing.
Can we talk
so
about
much.
This really quick?
I would love to.
Oh,
so
I wasn't wrapping.
It sounded like you were wrapping up.
I just wanted to thank him. I mean, that was
no. I knew he was going to come in. I didn't know he'd come in with this much.
Yeah,
that's
but I knew he was
going to
come in and hit it out.
I don't
of
even know what I know. I forget. I forget a lot of.
No,
I wish I knew what I knew.
Yeah, you got mad at us because you didn't prepare a joke. Meanwhile, you rattled off 30.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't mad. I always like to come in and do a good job. And when I don't know what it's about, I feel like that maybe I won't do as well as I could have done if I had known before.
Right.
So I didn't
Well, you're
know,
doing a great job.
I didn't know, well,
but
thank
I do
you.
Have
Thanks.
A question.
I appreciate it. Go ahead.
What made you get into entertainment? What made you get into comedy? You were a dentist
when
first?
When I was 12 years old.
So you were always doing...
I was always writing comedy from the time I was a kid. I just grew up in the Bronx, and I never considered it as a potential avenue to work in. I never considered it as
a
career. I grew up in a middle-class area in the Bronx. No one in my family had ever even gone to college. They were all in the garment center and the liquor business. My grandfather owned a nightclub. So when I grew up, and it was a very well-known nightclub in the 40s, it was called the Red Mill. Burl actually knew of it.
Wow.
And Joey Adams performed there. And a bunch of the older comics
knew
my grandfather, Herman Kay. So I grew up around show business and gangsters, and that was always my thing. I was always attracted to that. So when I was 12 years old, I decided I wanted to be a dentist. I wanted to be a doctor, but I was too sensitive to handle life and death situations. So I figured I like being
Molars
a dentist.
And canines.
I figured the worst that could happen is somebody's nerve will die, but at least the person won't die. I could handle a nerve dying, right? So, and I used to think, but if you want to be in show business, how can you also be a dentist? And it used to confuse me. And so I could never decide, and I wound up doing both at the same time. And it was a very difficult thing, to be honest with you. It was a really hard thing to do, but I managed to do it. Cindy Adams said I did it so that I made people laugh to see if they had any teeth missing. That was her conclusion.
Hey, you're laughing.
But
that
I do want to
could really use a little.
We will. We have not talked about a drink, but we're going to talk about your book because what were you saying about
this is a
helium?
Really important book for me. I'm very involved in healing and alternative medicine. When I was teaching, I was at a major university, and because I told such filthy jokes, I won't say what it was, but it was a major university in New York.
Trump University. I
was a clinical professor in oral medicine and orofacial pain, and my specialty was headache therapy caused by stress from bruxism, grinding and clenching your teeth.
Oh, really?
That was my specialty, TMJ problems. I was a cosmetic dentist for many years, and I was... until I was in my 20s, I was a very severe stutterer. I stuttered very badly.
Really?
I couldn't even say my name. Yeah. And I developed a cure for stuttering. I was determined not to go through my life as a stutterer. And it's a horrible disability, even though people make fun of it and they joke about it. It's terrible. And so my parents took me for speech therapy, and no one was able to help me. And I realized one day that I didn't stutter when I was alone. I could go into a room by myself and say everything perfectly that I wanted to say. But if I was trying to talk to you, I couldn't do it. And that told me you can't have a disability based on your location. You know what I mean?
Brilliant.
If a man has a limp, he limps in every room of his house. He can't go into the room, close the door, and walk perfectly. But if I could speak
Joel
well
does
alone.
Joel does if there's food in the kitchen.
He does, right? So I realized that there was really nothing wrong with me. I created it in my head, either through low self-esteem, lack of confidence.
Pressure.
Whatever it was, nervousness. So I worked on myself for years, and I developed a cure for stuttering. And I realized that you could change a thought. Any thought that you create, you can uncreate. Each one of us, everybody in the world, is functioning with thoughts that are not valid. And very often, they're thoughts that work against us. A lot of us create, they're thoughts sometimes that are given to us by strangers. If you were bullied as a kid, And most of us were in some way, because what kid is perfect? We all, kids are fucking mean, right? And so we're bullied, and we tend to believe what these people are saying about us. And very often we get negative images of ourselves. And we hold on to that, and I call them heart wounds. Anytime anybody has ever broken a promise to you or hurt your feelings in some way, you keep that inside of you. There's this bullshit saying that they teach us, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never harm you, which is the furthest from the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Because all the bruises you had when you were a kid healed a long time ago, but every single one of you can remember something that someone said that hurt your feelings as if it was yesterday.
Well, it was for me. Yeah. Rick Adonna called me a lesbian.
Well, see that? See that? And so that's
he hasn't
a heart,
recovered
that's
for
a
weeks.
Heart wound. So we carry these
it's
heart
a truth
wounds.
Wound.
We carry these heart wounds with us, and they affect our self-esteem and our self-confidence, and they affect every decision that we make. Every time you have to make a decision in your life, you use your thoughts to think about what you should do, right? Who else's thoughts can you use? And if your thoughts are faulty, your decisions are not going to work for you. So I wrote this book. This book is a lifetime of work for me and thought. It's called Healing Your Heart by Changing Your Mind, and it's showing us the ability to release the pain that we're holding inside of us and change the way we think, because you can change a thought. Any thought you create, you can uncreate. So one of the main themes is like, you can't change your past. The only thing you could change is your perspective of your past, the way you look at it. And there's a whole spiritual element to it, which is why I have a picture of a dog meditating.
Brilliant.
And if I hold it very close to the mic, your listeners can see it probably.
Did you see that?
We'll make sure.
Right up
and I have
mic,
amazing
though.
Reviews. If you look on the back of the book, I got great reviews from psychiatrists and psychotherapists, people in the field who validate my theories on how to achieve happiness by changing the way you think and getting rid of all the bullshit that is cluttering our minds, all the negativity that we carry with us that is given to us by other people.
I had to tell you, man, when you told me about the book, you sent me the link. And I was so excited. I went out and I have it on Amazon.
Really?
And I just love the cover. Well, I want a physical
It's a great
copy.
Cover.
Thank you. Thank you. And
the,
you know
it's
what?
A little dog.
I want to read both these books now. So
It's very reaffirming to me that it became a bestseller on Amazon. People are really resonating with it. And they're putting up reviews like it's a life-changing book. People are saying, first of all, I never open myself up. I don't often talk about my own life and how I feel about things. I just... Ron Bennington always kids me about that. He's like, you keep everything to yourself. But in this book, I really opened up and I talked about very personal things, you know. And I gave examples, you know, when I got divorced, it was a very painful thing because I had two little girls that were my heart. But my ex-wife remarried and had two other children. She adopted two children and had another one of her own. And those two children needed to be adopted and that little girl needed to be born. And that couldn't have happened had I stayed. And so when you think about your life, sometimes in retrospect, you can see the reasons why certain things happened. And that can give you a sense of peace. So many people go through lives hating their exes. But if you ever had children with somebody, they couldn't have been those children if it wasn't for that person. So
That's a great point.
You're wasting part of your life if you're hating somebody that you were with for any period of time. Once you exchange energy on that level, like I never remarried. I've been with a lot of girls, but I've never remarried. So there's nobody else that I exchanged that level of intimacy with. So to me...
But he got down and dirty.
No, but I honor my ex-wife as the mother of my children, and we're close. You know, I go to her house with her new husband. Her new husband owns a garage. Right? He's been her husband for a long time. And he fixes my car. And to show you how much I trust the guy,
cables don't work.
I was going to say, to show you how much I trust the guy,
I let him do my brakes. That's how much I trust the guy. And that's all because of the principles that are in this book.
Wow.
That if you lead your life according to certain principles, that your life becomes easier. You think differently. And it's about letting go of resentment, letting go of anger, just trying to lead your life according to certain principles. And
where can everybody find
principles.
Your books?
They could find it on Amazon. All of my books are on Amazon. But I'd really like it if they started with this, Healing Your Heart by Changing Your Mind, a spiritual and humorous approach to achieving happiness.
I'm in.
Great.
I think that's a great way to go out.
Absolutely. And we're going to post a link
and the picture of this for it.
When you say we meet, awesome. You mean you.
Yes.
Because yeah. I can't.
Because you're the producer and you know how to do it.
Yeah. You're on to me.
Somebody has to know how to do it. I really thank you guys for having me on.
No, Jeff, thank you. What a great show.
This
really.
Was really, really nice.
That was drinks, jokes, and storytelling.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Buddy, that was awesome.
Thank you, man.
Tremendous show. Right.
Yeah. Last call. Thanks for listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.